Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People, where our goal is to look beyond the superficial and reveal the essence, to explore hidden dimensions of life's challenges, and discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of our minds, our bodies, our emotions, our behavior, and our shared spirit. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations, practical tools, inspired thinking, and experiential guided imagery meditations to integrate the wisdom our guests bring us at both the personal and the collective level. One of the most difficult lessons that I've found in my life is that people seem to find it so difficult to see the truth. I realized early in my work that if people could see the truth, they could bring healing to themselves and their families and their communities. But my, how difficult it was to help people look and to truly see. Instead, people seem to spend most of their time making themselves unhappy and making others unhappy. And then they blame it on the outside world. The truth is, I found, is that we do have the power to change our world, to take care of those who are needy, to find personal happiness. It is a happy day in your life indeed when you find your personal mission. And so today's guest is one that I met during my most enlightening journey recently to the Middle East. One of my purposes of going was so that I could feel the current pulse of the people of that region, and particularly I wanted to get to know better some of the women of the Middle East. And for me, that means going and opening my heart, because that's how I get my most important knowledge and wisdom. And that's how I appreciate beauty. And speaking of beauty, I found the women there incredibly beautiful. Now, I was in Dubai, which is known for its beautiful women, but my goodness, one after another, as I watched them come into my classes, I was almost dizzy. And then Zaina Abdul walked in, and my wife and I were both mesmerized, because there's something special that she radiates. Physical beauty, yes, but more than that, something else. And I had the good fortune to be with her and have her tell me her story. And as she did, I realized that she's one of those of us who is fully in the process of awakening to her true potential. And I felt that a conversation with her would serve us all as an inspiration. So as you listen to her story, I want you to listen deeply. I want you to hear her heart. I want you to open to feel the resonance with a deep part of you, to really listen with your whole being. And for those of us who believe that empathy is one of the highest and most human of our abilities, why don't you take this as an opportunity to practice being open, being empathic and feeling. So, time to relax if you're in a place where you can. Focus your mind and open your heart to the power within. And welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Allow your body to relax. Bring your awareness inside, and if you can, let your eyelids close. Be aware that there's no other place you need to go at this moment. There's nothing else that you need to do. And go to that deep place within yourself where you feel inspiration, where you're in touch with that deeper part of yourself, the spirit within, the soul, whatever you might call it, your center. And sense the power and passion of your personal mission. Think about why you're here, really, what you're here to do. And be aware of the gifts and talents and skills that you possess. You know, no matter what it is, if it's in art, or if it's in being with people, or athletics, and caring for others, loving, what are the gifts, the talents that you have? And take a moment and allow yourself to feel gratitude to the source of all these gifts. Give thanks. And allow your heart to be open, to participate. And allow yourself to experience this, sister. When I first met you, I learned pretty quickly that you had been the first Arab woman to reach the summit of Imjatse, or what's often known as Island Peak, which is like 4 miles high, and that you had climbed it in order to raise funds for pediatric cancer patients. And I knew at that moment I really needed to have a conversation with you. So welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People.
Hello, and thank you for having me with you.
You're welcome. So it was a very stormy day there in Abu Dhabi when you were born, yes?
Yes, indeed. I like to think that I stormed into my parents' life. I'm the third child of my parents, who actually didn't want a third child, so they had enough with my brother and sister. Uh-huh. But it seemed like I pushed it and made sure that I came I came into my life, and ever since, my dad always referred me to being a storm, whether in the house, whether in everything. Yes, indeed.
All right. And so a significant part of your growing up was in Lebanon, yes?
In terms of years, I grew up in Lebanon. I lived there 5 years. But I think the significant part is really the effect it had on me.
Yes.
More than anything else. It really shaped a lot about my understanding of human being, of pain, of absurd relationship, I guess. Yes, this is what shaped me. So from the age of 4 to 9, I was with my mom and my siblings in Lebanon, while my dad kept as a security his job here in the UAE.
Uh-huh. And there was a war going on at that time.
At that time, there was a war, and this is what really, I think, instilled in me the idea that there's something not going on right in the way we live. Of course, the war was, you know, a lot of pain, a lot of fear, a lot of fear, and not a normal environment for growing up. In one way, you had the beauty of life, of being a child, of discovering the season, and on the other hand, you had this insanity that was raging all around, and my brain couldn't understand the why of what was happening.
Mm-hmm. So a good deal of fear by the violence that you were experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Uh-huh. And where did you go next when you left Lebanon? What happened?
So we actually escaped Lebanon. This was also a very traumatic experience, where we really had to, you know, jump on the last boat and cross the ocean. And the ocean was obviously you know, it's always those days where the ocean is roaring and everybody gets sick. And it was really a hard escape from Lebanon. And we came back to Abu Dhabi, so to a very peaceful, green, beautiful environment where it was all about, you know, growing the country, growing the city in a very good and positive manner. And finally, we were back to peacefulness. But yet it was very difficult for me. The thought of my family was left behind, my family in the sense of my cousins, my grandparents, that I couldn't see anymore. Or if I would see them, it was stolen moments when, you know, we could go to Lebanon between two bombings that had stopped.
And who was the war between at that time? What was that struggle about?
Anything and everything, I guess. I think it was a playground for religious beliefs, for political beliefs, for national beliefs, for international forces. I never really, it might sound weird, I never really followed or believed in the politics. I've always felt like we were Muppets of something, of some people that had greater intention. So some people will tell you very clearly, oh, the war in Lebanon was between this fraction and this fraction. I think it was more between human beings' egos and beliefs, or lack of beliefs.
So meanwhile, Abu Dhabi was really just, I mean, they had, I guess the prices of oil had begun to skyrocket. So suddenly this little simple place was becoming pretty popular, yeah?
Correct. And it was thriving. And you could see that as opposed to many other places in the world, the good that they were receiving, so in terms of financial rewards because of their oil, they were redistributing and sharing it with the whole country and making sure that this country would grow into a welcoming land and into a sustainable place. So yes, it was kind of weird to witness a real positiveness in people, a real goodness that was happening in Abu Dhabi, and while few kilometers away, people were just battling in war for something that I guess they haven't understood until now.
And Abu Dhabi was quite a hub, an international center, so you got exposure to a number of different cultures there, didn't you?
Indeed. We grew up in, and I loved that about being in Abu Dhabi, is that you could be on a table of 15 people and have 12 different nationalities and people just flocking together in one place for a certain amount of time. And usually, although living in an expatriate environment can be difficult in the sense that you probably don't build 15 years long relationship, but what you have is that at the moment that all these people come together, they just want to share a good moment. Everybody is uprooted. Everybody comes from a different kind of part of the world, so they want to understand who you are, where you come from, and share, even if it's a year, 2 years, 3 years of a life together.
And then you went on to Switzerland. What took you to Switzerland?
My parents. I was supposed to choose a very serious and reliable diploma. So at that time, when I graduated from high school, there were no universities yet in the UAE. So the idea was, okay, Zena, now you have to choose yourself a proper career, proper education. I wanted to go into arts, but then I realized I was not artistic. So I kind of left it. I wanted to be a journalist. I love using words, and I just wanted to, you know, be maybe a spokesperson for what was happening. But then we let go of it automatically. And with my parents, we just, you know, my parents helped. They pretty much convinced me of getting into hotel management in Switzerland, which seemed great for me because it was, again, a microcosm of what I was living in Abu Dhabi. So a lot of traveling, a lot of different people doing different things. It was a world on its own. So I went off to Switzerland to study hotel management in what is supposed to be the best university college in the world. Yeah, mm-hmm. So I graduated there from a Bachelor of Science in International Hospitality Management.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so, of course, you came back to the UAE, and did you start working in that managing hotels or?
No, absolutely not. I started my career in marketing and communication. My first job was in an advertising agency, actually, and that was pretty much it. I worked for a year here in Dubai and then got married and went back to Switzerland and started working for medical companies. But all my life was in marketing, communications, event, putting a word out there for whatever product I was working on.
Uh-huh. But now, actually, you had decided much earlier in your life you wanted to do something about changing the world. When did that happen?
I still have a very vivid memory of that day when I was 9 years old, uh-huh. More or less 9 to 10 years old. This is so I had just come back from Lebanon. And as we mentioned before, I had this imbalance between what my country was living and the luck that I had growing up in Abu Dhabi. And I remember telling my mom that we really had to do something about these orphans, and we had to build a place where they could, you know, all come together and play together and have a loving and reassuring shelter for them to stay at. So this is where it all started. And then, you know, growing up again in Abu Dhabi, I was kind of the, whenever some new people would come to school, I was known as, if you need anything, you just have to go to Zena. I was the reference, the kind of federating element. I always liked to know who was coming in, to make people feel welcome, to get them automatically into our group of friends so that they don't feel left out. And then again, the war in Kuwait started, and I was still living in Abu Dhabi, and we lived again the same fear and terror of what was going to happen. And I said, no, not again. This can't be possible. I mean, it's, don't people learn what is going on? So mm-hmm. I was 15 at that time and started questioning a lot the sanity of people who were supposed to protect us, the politicians and everything that was above us. But I still had my ideal and pure values. And I used to think, you know, when I was 18, I was going to join the army and go back to Lebanon and save my country and fight for the values. But as I was growing up, I was more and more, I realized that all of this was just a masquerade for greater intention. So I said, if I really, really want to do something, I cannot rely on others. I really have to do it my own self, with my own values and with my own beliefs. But then I went to Switzerland. I got busy with, I guess, you know, just getting through my diploma and living the young adult life that goes to university. But it was still in the back of my mind. I still connected with people on the street. I still... the notion of help, of giving, is something that was very strong to me. So I think unconsciously, even if I didn't really do something that I'm doing the way I'm doing it now, I always was, you know, the person going towards people in need in any form. Mm-hmm. But when really, really reality struck me is when I became a mom. when I became a mom, I felt I had this really strong responsibility and the power to do something. Because I had these two little boys. I have two boys who are now age 7 and 5. I felt that as a mother, as a woman, as a believer, we have so much power to give, and we can actually, this power is very dangerous because it can act very positively or very negatively on the children that we hold and that we love. And this is when I realized that, yes, just if, even if it was only for my children, but I had to do something on the long run.
And what did you decide to do?
Sustainable. So what I decided to do, this is, it started with, so when I started having this thought of, I have to do something, but I didn't know what. Again, I was busy growing up my children and working and making ends meet. And I came across an initiative that raised funds for pediatric cancer patients. So I said, yes, that's it. Let's start with this. And it does, it raises this money through clients. So I guess that I was in a moment in my life where I needed to physically and mentally challenge myself. So I took on the challenge not only to raise money for those pediatric cancer patients, but also to prepare for a very strenuous climb, which you're not supposed to do as a beginner. I had never climbed. I have the maximum that I mountained is skiing, leisure skiing every now and then.
Uh-huh.
So after 3 months, I decided to join the team. After 3 months of intense workout and fundraising, I managed to raise more than $40,000 for those kids and got ready, flew to Kathmandu and was just, you know, said, okay, that's it. We're going to go for this challenge now. I raised the money. Now you just head for the peak. To cut the long story short, you know, you go through all the thinking process and the physical element and pushing yourself to the limit. By the time you get to the mountain, come back. As you said in the introduction, I was very happy to know after randomly that I was the first woman to reach the summit of Iron Peak, the first Arab woman, sorry, to reach the summit mm-hmm. of Iron Peak. And on my way down, again, because of who I am, I connected a lot with the local population, with the Sherpas, who helped us. And I felt so funny because we had our latest gear and equipment and isolation and layer one, layer two, layer three, and the hats. And you would see them, you know, like with flip-flops going up and down the hills carrying kilos and kilos on their back. And again, I said, oh my God, we're so privileged, and yet we whine if we have a headache. And on our way down, we started connecting with those Sherpas and talking about the issues that a lot of children have in those remote villages of the Himalayas, where actually those children are get cancer. And it just stayed in the back of my mind, and it was a nagging thought. I had received so much from this population with their smiles, with their way they were welcoming us, they were hosting us, cooking for us, and I couldn't just keep it without giving back and without thanking them in a way. And it only started with one of the Sherpas telling me that he knew of a young child who needed help for his treatment, for his cancer treatment. So came back to Abu Dhabi, started connecting with him, creating my Smile for Hope Foundation to be actually able to fund the treatment of cancer patients from remote areas in Nepal. So this is where the movement starts. A few months later, I went to Antarctica on an environmental expedition. And there, random day, I was sitting on the ice and the whole group was playing together. I was with 70 other people from around the world. And I just stayed there and was observing penguins and interacted with some penguins. And it just struck me, I think everything that was building up in my head struck me that we're here for 80, 100 years. Those penguins, Antarctica, have sustained themselves for thousands and thousands of years. And here we come with our egos, with our big shoes. We stumble upon nature, upon ourselves, for such a short period of time on Earth. And we just don't look further than our immediate environment or our immediate life. So I said, no, there's something greater to all of this, and I need to do something about it, and I need Smile for Hope to be sustainable, and I need my kids to understand that we are here on a mission somehow. We are not only, we don't only come to life to just enjoy it and go. There's something, we have a responsibility somehow So where all of the thinking started. So Smile for Hope is now gently, slowly building up towards becoming what I dream of it to become, is a messenger and a catalyst of health. And I would like to see it go at everywhere where, to the forgotten places.
We'll get back to Smile for Hope in just a moment. Let me remind everyone that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People. This is Dr. Emmett Miller. This is a publicly supported program, and you can support us by visiting our online store at shopdrmiller.com. That's shopdrmiller.com, where you will find my audio and video programs, self-help, healing, peak performance, guided imagery, meditations, books, and more. You can learn more about today's guest and find other material related to today's show at drmiller.com/Zeina, Z-E-I-N-A. And Zeina Abdo is our guest today on Conversations. And tell us a little bit more about Smile for Hope and what you hope to do with that.
So Smile for Hope started again in Nepal from the simple intention of helping a pediatric cancer patient get access to medical treatment. Simply that. And I started realizing as I was helping this child that there is a cancer issue in those remote villages of Nepal. And there wasn't much being done about it. So I thought that will start being my battle, my angle of action. So I created this foundation, this organization in Nepal last year, and with the intention of really helping as many kids as possible, not only get access to treatment, but also what I understood with the child that I'm treating is that they leave their villages, which are 2, 3, 4 days walk from Kathmandu, and actually come to the capital where they stay for 6 months, 8 months, in a very confined environment, waiting, you know, to get treated. They go once a week to the hospital to get their treatment. And the rest of the time, they're just sitting in a 4-6 square meter room and waiting. So the second angle of action for Smile for Hope is actually to create shelters or to create welcoming place for those pediatric cancer patients where they can be together, where they can have an occupation, get tutors that come and help them for school so they don't miss out too much on school, and help them go through the process of treatment until they're ready to go back home. But in the meantime, giving them the hope, giving them a normal environment rather than just having those children not only go through the fear of the treatment, but also go through the pain of being cut off from society because they have cancer.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And of course, all the time that you're doing this, you have a couple of little ones of your own.
I do. I have two children, and they've already come with me last year to my first trip to Kathmandu, where we met the patient that we are treating. We are actually treating a 9-year-old Nepalese child from cancer. So my children were 4 and 6 at that time when we went to Kathmandu, and I really wanted them to understand that yes, there is pain, there are people who need us. We have to. It's part of our duty, I guess, but in a nice way. We have to help people. And even if there's a lot of pain, of misery, it can be done in a very positive way. So we spent 5 days in Kathmandu. We went to the hospitals. We went to orphanage. We visited our patient. And actually, my children have a very good memory of it. And we're leaving next week. We're going back to Kathmandu. And they're excited about it. And they're already, you know, saying, "Mom, remember, we promised those orphans that we were going to go see them again." And so it shows that even children at a very young age have this notion and understanding of what it is to do good and to give.
Yeah, wonderful. And of course, the other thing is, this actually isn't your day job.
No. This is my after 8 p.m. job and mission. I have a full-time job. I actually raise my children alone. Their father lives in Switzerland, and I live with my children here, and I'm a single mom. I do have a full-time job. I do have a day job that I have to attend to, but once my children are in bed, this is where I start my activity for Smile for Hope and for other things.
Well, your day job is a little bit different from the work that you started doing in the beginning. Tell us a little bit about what that job is now.
My day job is a very serious job. I work for one of the biggest real estate companies in the UAE, in Abu Dhabi. We deal with multi-billion, you know, dollars project, and my day job is it started as a marketing communications manager for one of the projects, but now I'm a lot into a business development, and I gave a spin towards a lot of social projects. I'm trying to develop a lot of social projects, which is totally in line with my heart, what my heart has to say.
The corporate social responsibility.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit more about what corporate social responsibility is.
So in the business world, corporate social responsibility is really about a company allocating resources, be it financial or human resources, in terms of doing good. So either a company can support a social project for its immediate environment, in terms of, let's say you extract oil in the middle of the desert, this has a negative impact on the environment. How can you as a company contribute positively to offset this negative impact? Do you, for example, invest in the education of the people? Do you invest in environmental initiatives? So this is what corporate social responsibility is about in a nutshell. How do I offset as a big corporation, or how do I contribute positively to the environment or to the business that I'm doing? So initially, I think it all started with the marketing and PR spin to it, saying, okay, you know, we're doing good, although we are depleting the resources here, we're trying to rebuild in this other end. But now more and more, I like to think of it as it's becoming a very conscious and responsible action in this book. And this is what I'm trying to develop in this part of the world. I would really like to support local population, to support environmental initiatives here.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes people talk about the triple bottom line, so that in addition to profit, you also think about your environment, and you also think about doing good for the people that work for the company, not just using them as if they're things, but treating people as people.
Exactly.
There is what we talk about is, you know, often we hear about someone called Martin Buber, and he talked about the I-thou relationship. He said there's two kinds of relationships that we can have with the world. One is our relationship with things. So you have a chair, so you just use the chair. You drink a glass of water. You don't pay too much attention to the water. These are just things that you use. But we go wrong when we start to treat people in that way, when we treat people like things. With the Industrial Revolution, you know, we discovered that instead of each craftsman making every item totally a one of a kind, that there are interchangeable parts. And so there's one company that just can make tires, and another one that can just make engines, and another one that just makes windshields, but they're all interchangeable. And so we ran into the problem of starting to treat people in that way. And you just hire somebody and use them until they broke down, and then you get rid of them and bring another one on. What Buber talked about is that my relationship with you needs to be with a person caring about who you are, knowing who you are, and seeing you as a completely unique individual. And our relationship extends out of my uniqueness and your uniqueness together. And so I think that some of that corporate social responsibility is to bring that thinking in, so that we really treat each other in a way that's honorable and respectful.
Absolutely. One of the things that again saddens me a lot is because of my brain wiring, and because mm-hmm. of the fact that most of, if not all of my career was built in multinational and really very big successful companies, I experience exactly what you were just saying, is that a human being, were a tool. I don't care about your emotion, whatever you feel. I remember at university, they would tell us, you're in a hotel, whatever you feel, whatever happened at home, stays at home. You need to come and put a smile on your face. So, yes, I do understand, but somehow it removes the humanity from whoever we are, because we all have to be plastered with a nice smile, whether we're happy or not. So it makes us live more and more in silos. We isolate ourselves from each other, and we tend to forget that the person in front of us is just simply a human being who has emotions and needs to be heard. And sometimes all it takes is a smile or a loving word, and that person is fine again.
Uh-huh. And where does your inspiration come from? Where do you get the, you know, after you finish a day's work, to turn around and devote yourself to first raising money, planning things, and then going out and doing these arduous trips, and yet taking care of your kids? Where do you think that inspiration stems from within you?
I think it's funny to say, because I think it's beyond me. It's a continuous thinking process. So I don't know how to say it. Is it something that just, I mean, the energy comes to me, the ideas come to me. 3 weeks ago or a month ago, I was in Madagascar with my children. And again, we go to those remote areas, and automatically my brain gets geared towards how can I help those people. I tend to see things and to make conclusions that normal tourists won't. They won't worry about, oh my God, these farmers are not eating, how can we do to help them? oh my God, this child is suffering from cancer. I need to do something about him. It's like if the energy, the ideas, the support comes to me, and I just have to act. I have to do it. And at the beginning, you know, because of the traditional thinking, you say, oh my God, but you have a full-time job and you have two kids, and how are you going to do all of this? And then suddenly you say, there's no problem. If I want to do it, I will do it because I have the support, I have the drive. And guess what? My kids will be part of the adventure. Let them, you know, come and learn. And so it's I tend to say it's just natural. It's me. It's my calling. It's probably why I'm here for.
You were having quite a an experience over on this side of the ocean with women becoming more and more empowered. And I guess when we hear about women in the Middle East, we kind of hear stories about them being very limited. You know, if your veil falls down, they stone you to death. And I mean, it's what's the empowerment scene over there right now?
It's beyond what we can imagine, and this is another thing that I would like to act for, is actually to shed light on this area of the world. Again, I realized through war that media really manipulate information and want the rest of the world to know what sells, whereas everywhere there's a lot of good happening, there's a lot of evolution, there's a lot of enlightenment. So why do we keep this, why don't we have a good news kind of challenge? And part of the good news was that actually Arab women are having a good time, are growing, are getting out there. So and they want to experience things, and they want to, it doesn't mean that it's becoming feminist and burning men in the middle and saying we are the leaders, we are, no, it's just about saying, you know what, we also have things we love to do, and we can do them just in a, as anybody else. So I started a program this year, just this past March, two students from the remote areas of the UAE came back from Antarctica. So I put on a place a program where we put forward a competition within their university, their college. So they had to answer questions, and then we did an interview, and then we got them prepared. We raised the money for them. And off they went to Antarctica for 3 weeks, which was unheard and unthinkable, because they are women from remote areas of the UAE where it's much more traditional and where they live in the desert. And suddenly, guess what? They're going to Antarctica, from sand desert to ice desert. And initially, I had a lot of people very, very suspicious and saying, yeah, skeptical about me, saying, there she goes again with her crazy idea. And when they actually saw in the newspaper that those two girls made it, they realized that, okay, there is something, you know, that can be done. And now the college loved the idea, and they're going to repeat it again next year, and the sponsors of these two girls love the idea, and they want to send more girls to Antarctica. So we created this movement.
Oh, great. Wonderful. A movement shuttling folks from the desert to Antarctica. That's pretty amazing. We just have a couple of minutes left, but tell me, what's on tap for you next? What's going to be next?
So, two major project nights. So, Smile for Hope always. My intention is really, I am now creating or joining an international network of organizations who really focus on bringing or bridging the gaps in health across the world in developing countries. So the angle that I'm tackling with pediatric cancer patients in remote parts of the world is something that complements. So in June, I will be attending the first international forum about how to improve and how to bridge gaps across the world with really action people. And I am also now fundraising for a new kind of web series that I'm developing, going to, again, remote and undiscovered places of the Arab world, on mountaineering trips and linking in with Arab women, or preferably Arab women, but it can be, you know, just local mountaineers, adventurers. And this has a very environmental spin to it, in the sense that I want to link to all the positive environmental initiatives that are created across the Arab world to showcase the beauty of the world that we have, but also to make people conscious about the fragility, and that even though Earth has been here for millions of years, it still needs our caring and attention.
Wow. And shedding a positive light on the Middle East and helping women tap into their untapped potential.
Absolutely. And some of these adventures, I will be joined by my children, because again, what one of the set ideas I would like to break is that it's not because you are a mom, it's not because you have young children that you cannot do. And we can all do something. A small plus next to a small plus next to a small plus makes a big plus. Mm-hmm. I know that not many people have the intention that I have of going and taking your kids for a 10-day camping trip in the middle of nowhere. But it doesn't mean that we cannot all together do something.
And for that really big plus, when are you going to climb Everest?
I am getting ready for this next year. Uh-huh. So I am calling the energy to bring me in the money, because it costs a lot of money. So I will be fundraising for Everest, if everything works according to plan, on next 2014. Next year, like now, I would probably be talking to you from somewhere in the base camps.
Wow.
On my desktop.
Well, we should certainly get together when you come back from Everest, and so you can share your adventures there with us.
Sure. Thank you.
And for those who are listening, if you'd like to learn more about our guest and maybe even contribute to this very worthy effort, just go to drmiller.com/Zeina. That's Z-E-I-N-A.
Since I recorded that conversation with Zeina, much has happened in Nepal. A very, very devastating earthquake. I'm sure many of us have contributed to those who are trying to respond to that challenge. And one of them has been Zeina, who, of course, took off to take care of her kids in Nepal. So do contribute. You know, it reminds me of that story about the four men are in a boat, and there's a hole in the boat, and the water is rushing into the boat, and two guys at one end of the boat have cans, and they're furiously bailing out, but it's they're not quite fast enough, and the boat's slowly starting to sink, and the other two fellows are sitting the other end of the boat, and they're not doing anything, but they're just sort of watching, and one turns to the other and says, "You know, I'm really glad the hole's not in our end of the boat." Now, I think that sometimes we're happy to sit back and watch these people who go out and give so much, and I will applaud them, and they even get to be a hero for a day or two. But how many of us really put our energy into something we truly believe in? Since I was in high school and even in grade school, I became aware of the fact that things were deteriorating rapidly around me, and no one else seemed to notice it. I could not believe that people were allowing the things to happen that are happening. You know, if you put yeast into a tube filled with sugar, those yeasts will grow and grow and grow, and if you graph it, boy, that's exponential growth. It shoots upward, but it doesn't keep going. At a certain point, there's so many yeast in the tube that the poisons that they exude from their growth, that they secrete, their waste products, actually begin to poison them. So they reach a maximum, and then the number of yeast actually starts declining. And, you know, I'm wondering if we're smarter than yeast, because that's what we're doing to ourselves with the poisons in our water and the poisons in our air. And if you've read Our Culture on the Couch, my most recent book, you know that my belief is that what we're looking at is violence, violence to ourselves, violence to our communities, violence to the air and the water. And in there, I turned about this either-or paradigm, that dualistic way of thinking, and the both-and paradigm. The human brain is designed to use both these paradigms in a balanced way, as suggested by the fact that the brain is functionally divided into two main parts. The left cerebral hemisphere is primarily responsible for the analysis, in other words, either or, black or white, us or them. It's responsible for fragmenting, analyzing, breaking things down, which is, I call it violence with a capital V, because it has to do with tearing apart. Meanwhile, the right cerebral hemisphere concerns itself with synthesis, putting together, both and, integration, creativity, relationship, wholeness, and love. And certainly there's times when you need to use the either-or paradigm. You have to decide whether you're going to get on bus A or bus B, and sometimes you have to defend yourself by saying, I'm not going to let him or her or them take this away from me. But we tend in our culture to rely too much on this either-or paradigm. Now, as we approach life, the number of choices that we perceive life as offering us is limited by two things. The degree that we are open to see the truth of what is, and the degree that we can free ourselves from the prejudices of the past. And we often find that exactly such prejudices are at the root of our problems. As the old saying goes, when the pickpocket meets the saint, all he sees are his pockets. We can only see what we've grown an eye to see. The New World paradigm suggests that your thoughts and feelings and actions are actually important. That's what the new paradigm says. It's not that you're number two and so you're the first loser, or you're not the cutest girl in the room, or you don't have the most money, or that you're not winning, or you're not the alpha. No, you are important. You are a meaningful and powerful part of the whole, and you have important decisions to make at this very moment in time. In a very real sense, your participation is critical. In other words, there's too many people sitting back watching and cheering, yeah, 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 do something good, and too few people who've really put themselves out there to do that. So as you put these ideas that we've been exploring today together with other things that you've been hearing and reading lately, you may find that there's a message that's meaningful to you. It may be that you're in the process of beginning to discover something that inspires you to balance and to heal within, and to balance and heal your relationships. Perhaps you've begun to feel a sense of a new hope, or at least a curiosity, as to what might happen if you were to explore and compare the results that you get by approaching things according to these different paradigms. In other words, if you include love and gratitude and serenity and acceptance and a willingness to be present in the moment as some of the techniques that you use to deal with the world around you. And if you have been able to feel that within yourself lately, then maybe right now it's about
time that you can begin to put these thoughts into action now, before the message gets drowned out in the next wave of distractions, the next presidential election, or the next terror alert, or whatever other distraction is being laid before you, so that you don't discover the power that you have within. You've heard Zaina's story. A woman living in the middle of the Arab world who's decided she has power inside and she wants to do something. Maybe she can be a model. Maybe right now, while you are aware of how crucial it is that you begin to nurture a certain change in your life, right now, make a plan to act. Act now. And as you do, know that we are at a very important time in the history of our little planet. How we husband our resources, how we balance our usage of our finite capacities, and how we care for each other lies in the balance now. So let's do that right now. And if you're in a place where you can safely do so, allow your body to sit back or lie back in a comfortable position. Take a deep breath in, and as you let that breath out, allow your eyelids to close. Let your eyes gently roll upward behind your closed eyelids. Picture the word relax in the back of your forehead. Let the air do the breathing for you. And as you relax, let yourself travel to your special place, some place far away from anything that could ever disturb you. Imagine yourself at peace. Anytime any unnecessary thoughts come along, simply breathe them out with your next breath out, emptying your mind and relaxing your body. Visualize your special place around you, wherever it may be, and imagine that in this special place, you are allowing yourself to take your awareness deep within, and you are making contact with a deep part of yourself, a spiritual part, so to speak, a place of wisdom, a place of power. And imagine you can listen to messages from this place within you, and those messages are telling you that you are important, that you have value. You are not an accident, and you are here with a purpose. You have a mission. Perhaps you already know what that mission is, or perhaps you can open your mind right now and receive whatever this deeper part has to share with you. What is it you're here to serve? And what would be the next step in your accomplishing that mission? Picture yourself doing that right now. How much commitment do you need to make that happen? Imagine you're giving yourself that commitment right now. Visualize yourself doing what it is that you're here to do. And visualize yourself being successful in your long-term goal. Feel how good it feels. And now let that happen. Great. And for those of you who would like to explore some of these ideas further, go to drmiller.com/Zaina, Z-E-I-N-A, and you'll see my suggestions for programs. Click on them, and you'll be taken into the shopping cart. And as you check out, simply write the word DREAM, D-R-E-A-M, in small letters, and you will receive a 20% discount just for listening. Thanks, and until next time, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com. Locate your desired program and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.